look back in anger. Class, regionalism, and the new wave, not the new wave of the music of the 1980s, but a new post-war wave of revolutionary thought, if not revolutionary deed. We're going to actually look today at a number of key things that relate to this whole phenomenon, as it's referred to, of the angry young men. Obviously, the name suggests, very gender-specific, very much tying in and focused on young male poets from pretty much the lower middle class or the upper working class in terms of their class background and class structures. People really like John Silkin, who we see a photograph of in 1960 in the street in Leeds, which obviously is bearing up well in its wintry February weather and so on. The 1950s and 1960s, as we've seen, are frequently referred to as decades which served as a reaction against the past. Certainly in terms of Britain, if you're looking at the overall focus, it was a reaction against the past. The past in which, as most maps of the time actually revealed, Britain effectively looked after pretty much a third of the world in terms of the civilised world, from Australia to India to South Africa through Canada and the West Indies and many, many more aspects as well. In other words, before the two world wars, Britain actually had an empire, hence the name British Empire, in which the three F's were very much to the fore: freedom, fraternity, federation. This notion of the imperial empire, and this obviously taken a map from the latter decades of the 19th century, was something in which clearly if you were in Britain, and if you happened to be British, and even more so white British, you were very much at the top of the tree. So you knew your place in the world, and that place was number one. Within British society as well, you also knew your place. The Queen was in Buckingham Palace, the MPs were in Westminster, and the landed gentry were in their various stately homes around the land. You would defer to the higher classes. You would look at people in the upper middle class and the upper classes in general as role models, people that you would look up to. You would look at them as clear examples of high culture, in which the very best of classical music, literature, and the arts would be revealed and demonstrated, and you'd also look at them as being administrators of the empire. If you were fortunate and you worked your way up through higher education, you may well be sent off to look after one of the far-flung colonies. In other words, you were developing an educational system which was designed for administrators, people who actually knew how to run things. And if you wanted to have a perfect example of somebody who really epitomised this whole sense of what it was to be British at the start of the 20th century, there's your man, Rudyard Kipling. Kipling was born in Bombay in 1865. He was born to an influential family. He was referred to as the people's poet. And amongst other things you may have heard of that he produced, one was The Jungle Book. He also produced the Just So stories. He also produced many influential poems that were sung or recited in music halls, in prominent newspapers, and indeed in recent times, when the English football team goes into battle in a World Cup tournament. In 1906, he published probably his most famous pre-Great War poem, post-Boer War poem. It was called If. If actually tells a young man what you need to know in order to be truly British, noble and heroic. I'm sure most of you will be familiar with If, but if not, I'll just give you a couple of verses from aforementioned poem. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good, nor talk too wise. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings, nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you and none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it. And what's more, you'll be a man, my son. All well and good. But the horrors of the First War, the Great War, the war that was designed to end all wars, changed everything. Specifically for Kipling, because his son John actually died in battle in the First World War, and Kipling's response amongst obviously the Great Depression was to produce another poem called The Children. Totally different in tone and register to If, it comes across very much as a poem about bad leadership, incompetent generals, and the loss of a generation of heroes for no good reason. You're seeing in terms of poetry here first signs of the sense of what poetry has at various stages always been used at. So has popular song, so has folk music, so have movements like punk and hippie and so on, which we look after. But it's a reaction, a rebellion against the culture and society. There's a couple of words from The Children. They believed us and perished for it. Our statecraft, our learning delivered them bound to the pit and alive to the burning. Whither they mirthfully hastened as jostling for honour. Not since her birth has our earth seen such worth loosed upon her, nor was their agony brief for once only imposed on them. The wounded, the war spent, the sick received no exemption. Being cured, they returned and endured and achieved our redemption, hopeless themselves of relief till death, marvelling, closed on them. But who shall return us, the children? Now clearly that isn't the Rudyard Kipling of Empire. That's an angry man who's lost his belief not only in war, but also all that war actually stands for. And this sense that somehow the rightness, the essence of the empire that was very much there, is slowly but surely being eroded. This sense that here's somebody who's very much part of the establishment, who can write so cuttingly, together with other poets like Rupert Brooke, and many of the wartime poets, Vidar Sassoon and so on, who kind of saw the sheer hell that was endured in the trenches. This is one of the key, clear examples of that. Spool forward 20 years, 30 years until the end of the Second World War, another generation, and the sorts of ideas which Kipling has put into place are becoming increasingly common. By the end of the Second World War, as we saw a few weeks ago back in Lecture 1 in this module, the Empire had been lost, and Britain was rapidly descending into a second or third-rate power. Deference as well had largely been lost, this sense of having respect for your betters on the basis of having a better place in society than you had been effectively eliminated. And after years of chaos and not one but two world wars, it was quite clear that people no longer believed in the culture, in the abilities, or perhaps more importantly, the competencies of the upper class. As early as 1946, the novelist Evelyn Waugh was able to state that England as a great power is done for. The British Empire was on the verge of final collapse. Not only were we in deep debt to America, we also had a whole range of other issues and problems at hand as well. And in 1947, the first country that effectively was the major slice away from ourselves and the empire was India. It was India under Gandhi and his peaceful protests, and the way in which that was developed, voted for independence. So well, so far so good. You might well say, well, that still leaves a lot of other sort of countries we've got there, I've got on hand. But that was the first major brick to fall. And gradually one colony after another lowered the Union Jack and went it alone. From the 1940s right the way through to the 1960s, Britain as a world power was clearly in decline. And in John Osborne's play, Look Back in Anger, Colonel Renfrew looks back in Indian independence and remarks, I knew in my heart it was all over then, everything. We'll come back to Osborne's work in a few moments. The writer George Orwell, 1984, and Animal Farm, amongst other things, wrote of his despair. He felt that throwing the empire overboard will reduce England to a cold and unimportant little island. British character, British culture, British ceremony and British style all seemed under threat. Interesting kind of echoes that we have in the current post-referendum Brexit era and so on. Inevitably, this collapse didn't happen all at once, because even in 1957, Britain still controlled 45 countries in the world. But by 1964, Ghana, Malaya, Cyprus, Nigeria, Sierra Leone, Tanganyika, Jamaica, Trinidad, Uganda, Kenya, and several other colonies were granted independence. And the empire in which the sun never set was slowly being seen as having a gradually setting sun across the British Empire. So, let's do the analysis. Why? Why was this? Well, some writers actually argued that America was intent on dismantling the European colonies, not only of Britain but also of France, in order to forward her own ideology, an ideology in which the world was made up of democratic capitalist states, where free trade, particularly American trade, could prosper. Other writers have actually spoken of a new sense of nationalism, a new sense of national identity which was sweeping through the world, with people insisting on governing their own affairs. And that's all there, but nationalist movements in the colonies were in the main weak affairs. They were often more about the ambitions of indigenous rulers rather than real self-democratic rule. Some of it inevitably was to do with the Second World War. The British Empire had been made up of a patchwork of delicately balanced relationships. The demands of war forced economic development, in other words, milking the colonies for all that they were worth, led to the formation of monopolies, and indeed other sort of aspects, food growing campaigns that didn't actually benefit the natives of particular countries, and enforced austerity all alienated the peoples of the colonies far and wide. However, it's fair to say that for Britain, in the main, the breaking up of the empire was a quiet affair. There were only two colonies that actually rebelled violently, Palestine and Aden. British politicians didn't generally seem to have the will to keep anything together. Indeed, Prime Minister Harold Macmillan was no admirer of the past, and he was looking forward to a progressive future. Remember that image of Kennedy pointing the way to the future that we looked at a couple of weeks ago? That future, basically, which saw strong relations with Europe and the United States. And any talk of empire for Macmillan was very much old-fashioned. It was 19th century as opposed to the 20th century. Either way we look at it, the dismantling of the empire is ultimately an act of political realism. Pace, in many ways, could be argued as being a little too fast. It was like knocking down a house of cards. There were instances of countries needing more time to effectively be ready for independence. It was estimated that Nigeria needed 25 years to be ready for self-rule, but a year after independence it was in the midst of civil war. There were military takeovers, and inevitably you get a momentum that takes on a life of its own. Meanwhile, as you'd expect in universities, intellectuals in Britain began to worry about the impact that this would actually have on British culture. How could we actually cope when effectively we didn't have this political and economic and financial influence upon the world? Actually, life tended to go on in most cases as before, because of the establishment of the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth is a range of countries, not only that provide us with the Commonwealth Games, but effectively they provide a loose collection of ex-colonial nations who effectively might not be part of Britain, but are still very much seen as supportive. This is where, in a sense, the soft rule of the monarchy, the visits of Her Majesty the Queen, royal family, to various former protectorates, former colonies, really begins to pay dividends. In addition to that, the annual Commonwealth Day, the Commonwealth Games, All of these are designed to ease the transition to individual occupancy and individual self-rule. In other words, this very notion of the Commonwealth as opposed to empire sees a representation of a collection of countries represented by a family of peoples with a shared history, all of whom are effectively working for peace and prosperity. But if you were being very cynical about this, you'd say, that's all well and good, but ultimately this is a painkiller to cover up the loss of actually ruling these countries. In many ways, the idea of Commonwealth, or a Commonwealth, would appease the right-wing politicians because they could actually argue that Britain was still a power in the world. It also was pleasing to politicians who are on the left-wing, or socialist aspect, because there was clear evidence that we were still actually helping colonies along. So in classic British terms, you might well say, it was the ultimate hegemony, the ultimate fix, the ultimate compromise between a group of countries that might have had very little in common other than their mutual hatred of the British. As I said earlier, there was a sense that the war had turned British society upside down, and that Britain accordingly needed to become a different sort of society, with a new culture and new university-trained experts and leaders who had actually come up from the middle classes. Elements of the social sciences, political sciences, economics, and sociology were all very much to the fore. And in any new society, you needed to have a reflection of the culture in that society with new art forms. And many educated young men would actually reject the high art of the past, the so-called canon classical aspects of the past, both in music and indeed in writing and literature, and argue that actually no one was really interested in what Britain actually did before the war. It was actually very much an outdated expression. Born before the war, almost as being bad in the 20th, as bad as being born in the 20th century. Just imagine what people now who are coming up to the approach to university in the 21st century, when you cast doubt and they say, well, we were born in the 20th century, how old would you have seen? The notion of reading Rudyard Kipling's stories of India and Empire, or indeed Anthony Trollope's lines on the ups and downs of upper-class families that were thrown out. Who actually cared about classical music or indeed opera? But at the same time, there's this sense of a gap. Where are the post-war writers and artists who are going to actually come to redefine Britain? Well, there's one of them. Kingsley Amis was probably the first writer to emerge, and often, although he actually rejected the label, he's regarded by critics as being the first angry young man. Amis was middle class. He was upwardly mobile. And after getting a scholarship to Oxford and graduating with a lower second class honours degree, I believe, he took a lectureship at Swansea University and finally settled at Hull. Amis was a jazz enthusiast, and he also reads and sometimes writes the newfangled genre of science fiction. In 1954, he published his first comic novel, a novel called Lucky Jim. And it's interesting when we look at the narrative of Lucky Jim, if you haven't had a chance to read it, I certainly recommend that you do so, to see what Amis is saying about the middle class feelings of the time. Jim is a medieval lecturer at a northern unnamed university who doesn't have any respect for his elders, for past tradition, or indeed for his own subject. He only chose medievalism because it had the easiest exams. In every sense of the word, he's a normal middle-class bloke. He's interested in jazz, beer, and girls. Anything more difficult makes him shudder. He's also quite anti any foreign ideas too. Inevitably, the book is somewhat controversial. As a book, it reflects the new world. It reflects the new world of the middle classes. A new world in which the welfare state is very much a part of people's everyday lives. So is education. But there is a sense that young people are being churned out of the universities with degrees, but they don't have any cultural education. So it's like processing peas. You're going through university, you're going to university, you're graduating, but what have you actually learned? Where's the education that's come through in that? How have you developed as an individual and so on? In other words, you get a degree to get a job, not an education. Lucky Jim reflects a world in which the new generation has no manners, no morals, and actually very little interest in anything except consumerism, seen through the eyes of Kingsley Amis. And what Amis is actually doing is, in the main, attacking what he sees as the pretentious intellectualism of the past. So quite simply, Lucky Jim is a work of cultural vandalism. It's not aesthetic, it's not politically aware, it's not particularly thoughtful. But what it does do is firmly and quite categorically rejects the past. The past epitomised by Terence Rattigan, who was one of the most successful writers that there'd ever been in the 20th century, the early 20th century. His first big success came in 1936. It was a play called French Without Tears, and it was about young diplomats. Other well-known Terence Rattigan plays, which have kind of been rediscovered and redeveloped for our 21st century, include The Browning Version and The Winslow Boy. And actually, in 1953, The Prince and the Showgirl, based on the Rattigan play, was filmed with Laurence Olivier and Marilyn Monroe in the leading roles. All well and good, and clearly a successful playwright. But what is he actually writing about? What's the topics that Rattigan is actually focusing on? Well, it's primarily conservative, well-crafted, middle-class, theatre-going stuff. It's full of clever insights into the class system and the subtleties of British society, the right approach for etiquette, when it's appropriate to have certain brass branches of cutlery, when you should defer to things, and so on. All of those subtleties were very much embedded within British society and British culture. And yet, at the height of Rattigan's career, the world had actually changed. No one actually wanted his kind of class-based comedies anymore. It was seen very much as old-fashioned. It was almost as though he was the equivalent of a walk-on girl for darts or Formula One. It's all passed us by. The following year, in 1954, after The Prince and the Showgirl was actually filmed, the English Stage Company formed, and their aim was quite simply to produce plays by new up-and-coming writers. The English Stage Company was generally regarded, and is generally regarded, as fairly important because it trained many famous actors of the late 50s and 60s and beyond. Alan Bates, Stephen Burkoff, Glenda Jackson all went through the English Stage Company. And they moved into the Palace Court Theatre in London. And after a couple of false starts, with a couple of their productions not having any major political impacts or indeed financial impacts, they were looking for something special. And they chose a play by an actor called John Osborne. And they offered him £25 for Look Back in Anger. Osborne himself was an out-of-work actor. He was living on a houseboat. But this play is considered a milestone in British theatre. It's considered very much a watershed moment because it really deals for the first time from the British point of view with a reflection of realism and realistic culture. Look Back in Anger is set in a small flat somewhere in the Midlands. Could be Nottingham, could be Lincoln, could be somewhere in Derbyshire, but it's somewhere in the Midlands. And the protagonist, Jimmy Porter, you see there on the right-hand side, portrayed by Richard Burton, he's fairly young, early 20s. He hasn't got any particular beliefs. He doesn't believe that there's anything really worth fighting for. He's fairly promiscuous. In other words, what Osborne is actually doing in this play is channeling very much that contemporary voice, the same contemporary voice that Amis was looking at in his novel Lucky Jim. That contemporary voice suggests a man who, whilst not necessarily being tremendously threatened by anything, actually doesn't really like the world. He's frustrated with it. There's a sense of boredom. There's a sense of a huge sense of loss. There's a sense of wanting to rebel, but not really sure about what it is he wants to rebel against. Again, in seminars, we look at the opening sequence from the filmic version, Look Back in Anger, and see all of these things being manifest. And it, the play itself, again, was at the Lincoln Performing Arts Centre a couple of years ago. Not everyone actually liked the play, but Kenneth Tynan, who was a young Observer theatre critic, actually does, and is very influential in his views, and acclaims it as a whole new start for British theatre. Inevitably, the play is a hit. It's made into a television play by November, because of course you've got the opportunity, if it goes well on stage, fantastic, we'll do a TV version as well. And it also begins to see literary and theatre reviewers who describe a whole generation of young writers who wanted to capture the magic that Osborne has actually put together and look back in anger as the angry young men. A new wave of middle and working class writers. Writers like Kingsley Amis, John Osborne, John Brain, Alan Sillitoe. All of whom were quite clear insofar as what they were writing about was the ordinary man and woman in the street. They were writing plays about ordinary people. Conformity was clearly out of fashion, but anger is in. Again, this anger is emerging from a time where the empire has kind of gone, Suez has kind of proven, if ever we wanted any sort of success, that actually we can't have it, that we're seeing an awful lot of our values imported from the United States. And although slowly but surely there are rises in living standards, it's still taking time to actually get through that process. And if you are in your early 20s or late teens and so on, you will have grown up pretty much in times of austerity. When you were an infant or an early child, you would actually be in the middle of the war, and so on and so forth. Now, were the new writers, such as Osborne and Tynan and Brain and others, actually offering a better representation of the world that people used to live in? Many ordinary people in the late 50s lived pretty much as they always lived. There wasn't a great deal of money. They still had to actually exist in pretty much shoddy Victorian housing. And in the industrial towns, certainly in the north, the conditions were pretty much one where you still had outside toilets, there was rubbish everywhere, there was gasworks, factory hooters, and tea was very much Spam and toast. So actually, maybe they were capturing this whole notion, almost, you could say, a bit like the writers of the 19th century. But whereas Dickens and company were maybe writing with angles for a reason, in this particular instance, they're simply writing partly for entertainment. And at the same time, as this is happening, the government is also pouring lots of money into whole new building projects. New estates, but inevitably, even though there's a lot of money going into housing, roads, and so on, there's never enough housing to go around. And it's estimated that in the late 1950s, about 7 million people lived below the poverty line. Meanwhile, 90% of the population would own less than 4% of the wealth. So 96% of the wealth was owned by 10% of the population. So was that any real change? Well, also happening in the post-war years, you have this large-scale import of social sciences from America. Social sciences like psychology, sociology, and so on. They actually brought a new interest in the whole question of poverty. The mass observation project cited in Bolton, both pre, during, and after the war, actually was looking at how the poor actually lived. And inevitably, part of the rationale for that is driven by mass marketing and market research. Because if you can find out how people are living, what they actually need is something which you can actually then sell them, hopefully, particularly in a consumer society. Knowing how people vote. Knowing how teenagers spend their money. Knowing how to sell a new type of washing powder to the housewives. Those social science courses opened up at universities across the country. And they attracted lower middle class and working class students. They were mostly men, and they were mostly Labour supporters. And that was very much the background of the people who wrote the New Wave novels and plays, several of which were actually turned into films. And yet there's this tension which is manifested in this little book, which deserves a slide with the cover actually featured on with the original Pelican book release of The Uses of Literacy, by Richard Hoggart. Written in 1957, what Hoggart does in this text is examines working class culture, but he examines working class culture from the perspective of himself a self-defined working-class man. Hoggart himself is typical of the upwardly mobile working class. He got a scholarship to grammar school, so he didn't have to go to a secondary one. He passed his 11 plus. He then went on to university, and he taught in the ever-expanding field of adult or further education. And the working-class industrial landscape that Hoggart describes is full of hardship, it's full of poverty, it's full of strained family relationships. He's actually arguing that the traditional working-class life, full of communities, full of people not having to lock their doors because there was a sense of community within the whole culture, was actually being destroyed by affluence and education. Because if you actually educate people, you also give them ideas. And those ideas might make them think that they're better than they actually really should think they ought to be. They want to move away. In other words, the traditional sense of community developed by the pub life and the music hall and so on were all giving way to the influences and the pernicious influences, as Richard Hoggart would actually say, of the mass media. Hoggart argued that education may bring freedom, but it's actually a false freedom because it destroys what's important about the working class and it also undermines decency. Interesting, whilst Hoggart wrote The Uses of Literacy in 1957, a few years earlier, there'd been another sense of having a proper canon of literature from F.R. Leavis in Cambridge, who was claiming that actually we were losing the sense of quality aspects of canon, and the notion of devaluing education, dumbing down, before you, the word became used in the popular vernacular of recent times. Was very much what Leavis was arguing about. I'll talk about Leavis again during seminars. But Hoggart effectively attacked consumerism as a corrupt message. He felt that although times were tough, as you can see in these sort of images that actually were here, what these tough times actually provided was that sense of community, that sense that actually we would still see things through. And we certainly wouldn't be influenced by America. These children are playing cricket, not baseball. In other words, consumerism was seen as a corrupt message, according to Hoggart. It was seen as cheap, sensationalist entertainment, which would destroy taste. It would be barbaric, and it would be meaningless. Anybody watch the American Super Bowl last night? Oh, they've been corrupted, oh no. The loss of centuries of music, centuries of ballads that people knew by heart, shared culture and history, all part and parcel of the things that were being forgotten. And they were being replaced by jukeboxes and throwaway American imports. Effectively, Hoggart was arguing that the young were giving up their heritage, and they were replacing it by buying into this vague dream, a vague dream which amounted to a few narrow consumerist elements. Fashion, style, in other words. Basically, it would leave the youth without any aims, without any ambitions, and ultimately, soulless emptiness. And Hoggart's book is very much a nostalgic one for a wartime north of England. A working class community and a sense of neighbourhood that, from Hoggart's perspective, was rapidly vanishing. That's certainly at the heart of many of the whole writings of the New Wave writers. The regions, the provinces, the terraced houses around the factories, communities basically which were still undeniably British, and perhaps more importantly and significantly, white British, were seen as being under attack. The literature of the New Wave can be summed up in one word, anti-American, or two words hyphenated, if you're being pedantry. It would be anti-shallow, modern mass culture. The authors would be seen as interested in the old world of the industrial working class. So you have an interesting irony here, insofar as here are the new wave, the first branch of people who graduated, gone through the wartime system, and yet they're arguing for a time in which, nostalgically, not that Britain has an empire, but that we should somehow not lose touch with our roots. Many of the new wave books were turned into films and were referred to as kitchen sink dramas. They would focus on working class poverty, they focused pretty much on aggressive attitudes to both sex, to women, crime, abortion, homelessness, unhappy marriages, everything you really need to have an episode of EastEnders, arguably. Movies such as A Kind of Loving, 1962, all would tend to have pretty much the same sort of plot. Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, inevitably you tended to have lead actors who had provincial accents, they had very similar plots, the protagonist would be working class, he would be stifled by the working class culture of the North, so you get a big sense of the North-South divide, he'd be dissatisfied, he'd be threatened by change, he certainly wouldn't be a hero. He wouldn't be a hero in the traditional Hollywood sense of the all-round hero that's being portrayed. And the landscape itself would be seen as bleak. It would have a lack of direction. There'd be a lack of identity, other than, as I say, this whole notion of vague northernness, which would be manifest in the whole sequence. The plots would be about beer, about brawls, about failed relationships, and about deprivation. Characters themselves, on the other hand, would also often be on good wages because they were usually employed. There was an awful lot of employment around, but that employment was usually factory work, it was drudgery work, it was keeping things going. The characters would also be seen as products of the welfare state, but ultimately they would be seen as living lives which were meaningless and spiritually empty. Now you could argue, well, hasn't this been influenced by the whole notion of existentialism? And arguably it was. Because the whole notion of Baudrillard's philosophy post-war in France and the agonised sense of the French existential philosopher that life is essentially meaningless, and what's the point? Ultimately, what is the point of anything? It's kind of maybe creeping into elements as well with this whole system. And in A Kind of Loving, that we see a slide from there, the man actually gets his girlfriend pregnant, and he marries her, but he doesn't actually love her. So again, you've got a whole range of sort of issues relating to that. In Billy Liar, written by Keith Waterhouse, you have this lead character, a fairly nasty young man called Billy Liar, who effectively treats everyone and everything with contempt. He keeps planning to leave his northern town, but finally actually it's his girlfriend, played by a young Julie Christie, who actually gets on the train to London and leaves for a new life. All of those films are very similar. And actually, in pure box office terms, they're not that successful as films. The people who actually watched them weren't working class. Why would they be? They go to the movies to be entertained, not to be reminded of the kind of miserable existences they've got in the first place. And these movies are predominantly in black and white as well. Whereas you can have colour and all sorts of exciting things if you go to make a different choice of the movies and so on. Audiences for movies such as Billy Liar, Kind of Loving, Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner in general tended to be young, they tended to be middle class, they tended to be educated. Because they were so similar, the actual demand for the films as a genre was pretty much exhausted fairly quickly. In other words, familiarity bred a lack of interest. Although arguably they all survive and survived as series like Coronation Street took hold. And then in the 80s, of course, EastEnders and so on. This whole notion of soap opera, drama, soaps would be sort of connected. Private Eye, the satirical magazine, actually ran a spoof with a novel called Stan Blister called A Waste of Living. So what did the New Wave actually succeed in terms of actually doing that? Well, it certainly didn't succeed in halting the collapse of the British film industry, as we'll see that needed an injection of something much more important in the late 50s and early 60s. The novels themselves, although they're still actually studied, they're still sort of dissected, and some of you might have actually looked at them in terms of your school-based work, they're still probably not as good as people thought that they were at the time when they were seen as daringly different. The very fact that Terence Rattigan has now come back into fashion, that things have kind of returned, come full circle in some ways, maybe suggests that what we've actually got with all of these areas is something which is culturally reflective of a society, of a North, of a particular time, but maybe it wasn't as revolutionary as the writers like to think it was. Remember that first booking for John Osborne, £25, which would be the equivalent of around about £2,500, thereabouts, maybe a bit more, a struggling unemployed actor. He wrote the play, it got turned on. Fine, success. It's fairly true to say that the actual films of the novels also didn't produce any significant British film directors, although again I've been engaged with discussion by some of the people who worked within the whole field. Lindsay Anderson certainly was a fairly famous director, but there wasn't the equivalent of an Italian Fellini, for instance. And did they actually solve any social problems? Not really. They were already in the process of arguably being solved by the mass clearances and the mass building projects that were already in place. So it wasn't, as I said earlier, kind of, oh, these are the 20th century equivalents of Dickens and Engels and company writing for the working class, trying to actually change the sort of images of society and so on. But what is quite interesting is that even though you have an idea of the North that may or may not be true, it does actually play on stereotypes. The novels and the films reject intellectuals, and they reject culture for culture's sake. Perhaps most importantly, they significantly reject American materialism. And the heroes, or anti-heroes, look down on everyone, resent everything, they bully women, and they reject everything except apathy. What is interesting, though, and certainly Sandburg actually writes extensively about this when he talks about the nostalgia for the working class past. Past in which somewhere in those depressing working class streets and environments, you may well find folks such as the young John Lennon, young Paul McCartney, people who didn't actually connect at all to the notion of Billy Lyon or so, but at the same time, they would emerge from the art culture scene, and we'll look more at these guys in a later lecture. To conclude this particular session, though, let's go back to that whole notion of where we came in with Rudyard Kipling's If and the Malcolm McDowell movie that emerged in 1968. Actually, this was in colour long after the heyday of the Look Back in Anger, Angry Young Men poets were actually there. This is generally regarded as the last of the new wave movies. Made, as we see there, in 1968, starring Malcolm McDowell. It's not an accident they used the title of the Kipling novel, or Kipling poem. It's quite deliberately set up in a British public school, and it follows a group of sixth formers. These are the same young men in the same public school as Kipling wrote about, but in 1968, the counterculture is in full flow. The counterculture that we'll be looking at slightly more in depth when we look at the 60s, and again we move to the 70s and so on. That sort of sense of revolution, change, adjustment in terms of what's being taking place and so on. And at the end of the film on If, on open day, we get this sequence in which the sixth formers get hold of automatic weapons and attack the school. Ooh. Columbine Massacre and all sorts of other areas in place that maybe our American cousins have been influenced by the Brits in terms of what to do with open massacres and so on. The headmaster of the school is actually shot in the head, and the whole movie is very much a tirade against the establishment. It seems a tirade against the old values, the old culture. It was quite clear that those values didn't have any place in this modern world of the 1960s, a world in which, as we'll see next week, Vietnam, civil rights, other areas of oppression and uprising are developing. But although there was a sense that in the modern world, old values didn't have any place, nobody seemed sure quite what was going to replace them. Thanks for your time, and I will see you in seminars. Make sure you sign the register as well. Thanks.